A quick apology, there are some sound quality issues with this episode, courtesy of us using Zoom to interview a guest. So we've done our best to pare them down, and we apologize for any inconvenience. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Mysteries, Monsters, and Mayhem.
I'm Shannon Lawrence.
And I'm MB Partlow.
Quick content warning before we get started. This podcast may contain language and disturbing content, so enter at your own risk. Hi.
Hello.
We're here. We're here again. It's been a pause. There's actually been a break for once.
The pause that refreshes.
Sure. Like, my boss asked before I went to work, so we got a week and 2 days paid off from work. I've never had a job that did that. For Christmas break. And so we got the Friday before Christmas off because Christmas was Monday, right? Mm-hmm. And then we had that week and then we had the first off. And she was like, so what are you going to do fun over the break? And I was like, I have a book to get ready. That's what I'm doing. I'm using this break to do what I can and set up some marketing stuff. And well, aren't you going to do something fun? Sure. But I don't know what yet. We'll figure that out when we're in the week. We did do fun stuff. We went to the ice castles in Cripple Creek and we had game night and we did stuff. But it's downtime for all of us, right? Like, we've got an adult, an extra adult in the house. And then my daughter just needs she only got a couple days off from swim over her Christmas break. They still had to do swim practice and they even had a swim meet over break. Yeah.
That does not seem right.
Right? I was like, really? Can't the athletes have a break? Not if it's your season, you can't.
I thought if school was closed, they didn't have events.
Nope.
Oh.
So did I. So right. I thought she was going back to school early, and I was like, that's not what the calendar says. Then we were like, we don't know when you're going back, because your calendar's unclear. It's like a Magic 8-Ball right now. I shake it, I look at it, and I'm like, yep, nope, uncertain. I don't know.
Future uncertain, ask again.
I'm like, stop putting the teacher stuff on here with the kids stuff, and maybe I can figure out when we go back.
Yeah.
So anyway, we need to introduce our guests before we go any further, because otherwise there will just be a random voice, and that would be weird. So
probably wouldn't be the weirdest thing we've done, but yeah, it would be.
No. on a tier, in a hierarchy of weird, it might be. We don't know where that
would rank, but... perhaps not the very tippy top.
Our guest is Angela Sylvain, and I'm going to let her introduce herself.
Hi. So really excited to be here with both of you. So I'm a horror writer, have known both of you for a long time in the Colorado writer circles, and I write short fiction as well as poetry and novels. I've probably got like 50-ish publications out there in various anthologies and podcasts and whatnot. And then I also released my first novel last year, which is called Frostbite. It's a sci-fi horror comedy. It's kind of like Gremlins meets The Faculty meets Fargo. Is kind of so very like wacky, gory, lots of like creatures. It takes place in the 90s, so it's very nostalgic. But also has kind of a Midwestern wintry heart. So, yeah, that's me.
And it's because you're from the Midwest, right?
Yes, I'm originally from North Dakota. And I have many unpleasant weather memories.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
I read Frostbite over Christmas break.
Oh, you did? Awesome.
And I loved it. And what you probably don't know about me is that I hate prairie dogs with a fiery, burning passion. So it was the perfect book for me. I was like, yes.
That's awesome.
We were in a critique group and somebody had written.
Becky.
different Becky than we usually mention.
Not Becky here. Clark.
But our friend Becky had written something with prairie dogs. And
they were cute.
Just like, across the. She was so mad.
I was just like, I consider them plague-riddled vermin. But
it was like, wow, I do not have strong opinions about prairie dogs either way. But
well, I have to say, you're the first. I get a lot of comments that people are like, oh, those poor little prairie dogs. They're so cute. So I'm glad to hear the alternate viewpoint here. That's like, you know, no sympathy.
I can usually be counted on for the alternative viewpoint. But no, but the book was good. And it did. It had a lot of funny moments. It had a lot of really touching moments. Her relationship with her mom was really, I thought that was really well done. And it's really impactful to a lot of people right now.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. That was something I wanted to kind of handle carefully. Obviously, when you're struggling with a parent going through something, that's certainly, you know, always a challenge. But also anyone who's had a family member with dementia, it's mm-hmm. just really tough. So, and I have dementia runs in my family as well. So it's very like personal kind of story to tell. And I want to make sure to be careful with it and genuine, you know, so I'm glad that came across.
It did very much. Well, it was very well done. And I really liked the crusty neighbor too.
Yeah. Everyone's a fan of Calvin. Calvin, the like crotchety weird neighbor is really popular.
because he was a complex character. He wasn't one note. He wasn't like just crusty and mean. And he wasn't like a big softy with a heart of gold. He was a little bit of everything.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. You never, like, at first you kind of want to dislike him because, mm-hmm. you know, he doesn't always say the right things and he can be a little offensive. Also, he's very into taxidermy. It's creepy, you know, but then he really kind of comes through. You find out he's willing to, like, you know, fight for his friends. And yes.
That's always a good thing. There has to be something. There has to be a nugget in there.
Right. Definitely. Most people are very complicated. So,
and now I have reminded, I've written a note to myself to go in and review it on Goodreads. So,
well, thank you. I appreciate that. You know how that goes. We're always begging for reviews, aren't we?
Yeah. It's like the hardest thing to get. It's like they buy your books and you're like, great. Please help me. Please do a review, please.
I start out every year with high hopes that I'm going to at least go to Goodreads, if not Amazon, so I can track all the books I've read. So yeah. I don't reread stuff. It's more for my poor memory than anything else. And this year I did the best. I got up through like September when everything kind of went to shit anyway, but I kept really good track up until about September, which is the longest I've ever kept track. So this year I'm going to track the whole year.
I like using Goodreads to track too. And the challenge for me becomes, I think more and more nowadays I'm reading ARCs mm-hmm. for people. And then I have to remember to actually go and review things when it comes out, you know, because yep. some places you can't review things early. So it's a little bit of a struggle, but.
I did better. So here's the thing, though. I did the Goodreads challenge, and I read over the amount, so that was good, because the previous year I hadn't made it. And so this year I started out just dedicated to making myself more reading time.
Yeah.
Mental health. But I did not review them. I did the stars, right? Mm-hmm. So they still got stars for me, so it still count for them. But I was like, if I do not force myself to sit there and try and do a review, like in words every time, this is going to be more doable for me to get it done. But I track by, because I take a picture when I start reading something and I post it on Instagram, and then I can just go to my Instagram feed and scroll.
Oh, that's smart.
And then I look for what I read since the last book I reviewed, and then I can just do them all at once. And then that's what I did. And that worked for me this year, so I'm sticking with it.
That's a great idea. Plus, then you're also like, you know, promoting what you're reading. It's perfect.
Right. I'm like, let's share this. And then they can ask me, and they do. People do. Like, did you like it? Because I'm posting it right when I start so that I'm not posting it with a review. But I am not. Reviewing it in words is not my specialty unless I really had something I wanted to say. And that's why I was like, I was putting way too much pressure on myself. Some people go in and they have this weird natural, I have written 3 paragraphs about this book that I've read. And it's like, it sounds like a professional reviewer, and I'm like, that's not gonna happen.
I have tried that too. It's too much pressure. Now if I write a review, it's usually like 2 sentences.
Right.
I write something to remind me of what I liked or didn't like about the book. And I also am very careful to include, I just reviewed something the other day, and I said this factor on this character was not to my taste, but that's just me. That's a me issue. I said it was a mystery. I said it was, the writing was good and it was well plotted, but there was an aspect of the main character that I just really didn't care for. But, you know, don't not read it because of me. But I generally only write like a sentence or two to remind me of what I liked or didn't like.
Yeah, one of my common things is, you know, really good characters or, you know, one-dimensional characters did not enjoy. Like, can't do it. So that's one of the major things that I look at, which is funny because, like, I wouldn't say that I'm all about character-driven, but if I don't like the characters, then it's not going to work for me. Especially when you're reading horror all the time, there has to be something about the characters to draw you in.
I just DNF'd a book.
Right.
DNF'd a book that everybody loves, that people are recommending to me. And I tried it and I was like, I don't like the characters and I don't give a shit what happens to them. So I'm going to stop reading now.
I feel bad because I've been struggling with a local indie writer's book and I want to support, you know, I try really hard to support that and get that out there. And I think I'm going to have to DNF it. And I'm never, ever going to say what that person's name or book was. I'm not doing that. But
right,
I'm just like, I want it to be able to finish it and recommend it and put it out on the BookBub and put it out, because that's what I do if I like it at the end. You know, when I do that Goodreads thing, then I also bop over to BookBub and put it there too. And then I share that out to social media because they make it easy on BookBub to do that. So yeah, I'm like, oh, I've put it down and read two other books. I tried reading an anthology, Don't Whistle in the Dark, which is the Native American. Yeah.
I bought that one for Christmas.
Is it good?
Yeah, I mean, it's mixed. Stephen Graham Jones just did the intro. He doesn't actually have a story in it, but a friend has a story in it. So that's awesome. And it's her first published, I think. So she's Cree. And so, yeah, that's in there. So that was pretty cool. And anyway, I was like, I'll read one story and then I'll read two chapters of this book. And I did that for a couple nights. And I was like, man, I just want to relax. I can't keep doing this. Why am I doing this to myself? And then that person has like a new book coming out. And I was like, no, I'm sorry. No.
There's only so much time and words you can read, you know, at some point you got to cut yourself some slack, but I'm with you. I usually don't say anything if I don't like something.
Right. I will not.
If I DNF something, I'm like, all right, no one has to know. That was
right. Exactly. No, I won't review it. I won't post that I hated it. Now, if it's like if it were a Stephen King and I hated it, that one I wouldn't have a problem being like, you know, I'm going to give this 2 stars because he can handle it. And maybe sometimes they need to hear. But we'll see. You know, like sometimes I'm just like, let's knock Stephen King down a notch. Let's. No, I'm just I don't think I've hated a book I read by him, but
There was a series that Nora Roberts put out. Mm-hmm. It was I think it was just 3 books. One of your brothers read it because I posted about it and he commented on it. And that's how I know it was your middle brother.
Okay.
I was like, oh my God, did you read the second book yet? But so it was a fantasy. It was a modern fantasy novel. And the first book was so good. I just tore through it. Couldn't wait. Read the second book and I was a little bit like, huh, this seems like just a little bit of a rehashing. And then the third book, I was like, and I went on Goodreads and I said, I am sorry. I expect way better from this author because she knows how to write a book. And there were no stakes in the third book. You knew everything was going to turn out okay.
Yeah, no. What's keeping you reading then? You
know? I just kept turning the pages going, but I know how this is going to end. I know how this is going to, because.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, I don't even remember what it was. I think I saw that because I think I saw my.
I would highly recommend the first book.
Okay.
And then just be done. Just walk away. Just let it go.
I read like some Key series from her, and that might have had 3 books, but it was romance or something. Yeah, it was all.
That's what I was going to say. I thought I recognized her name from romance.
She also writes under J.D. Robb, though, and that's why I gave a different book a try, because I read her J.D. Robb, and it's sci-fi mystery or sci-fi thriller. Sci-fi mystery.
Or police procedural.
Yeah. So those ones are really, because she's like, Eve Dallas is a cop in the future. Out there, local wars or something, but you really don't go into the wars a lot. It's almost post-apocalyptic. What they call them, really?
Urban wars?
Yeah, something like that. And so then she's investigating things, and of course there's heavy romance thread through it. But
it lightens up later in the series. I mean, they're still together,
yeah. Right? You can only.
It's not like will they, won't they?
Right, right. No, you're like they will. And they will sometimes.
They will a lot.
But she is, after all, a romance author. So, yeah. But no, I do like that. Well, it's been a while since I've read in it. like all my series drifted away, you know, like I got bad about following series.
I find she's a comfort read. Like if I'm just at wit's end and I can't concentrate on something new or something complicated, and I can pick up a J.D. Robb book, and it doesn't matter if I've read it before because I've forgotten how it's going to end. I know it's going to end okay, though.
Yeah. She's going to figure it out. It's fine. There's going to be trauma.
Yes. But it'll all work out in the end. It's a comfort read.
Okay. I have that, too. Though I read mostly horror and like a few mysteries and thrillers and things, my comfort read is the Lady Sherlock series. So it's Victorian woman who's actually Sherlock Holmes. But it's like totally opposite of what I normally read. And it's very comforting. It's like solving Victorian mysteries.
I just think for me, that's like the Janet Ivanovich books, the humor books. Yes. Have you heard of that? Okay.
Yes, totally. My mother-in-law loves Janet Ivanovich.
Yeah. I even got away from that one, even though normally I'll laugh my way through it, sitting there, but mostly I read before bed, right? So my husband's passed out next to me, and then so I'm reading that and I'm laughing at it.
Mm-hmm. Grandma Mazur
and her sidekick. Oh my God, Lula. There we go. The ex sex worker with a heart of gold. Who has different hair and a different outfit every time she pops up in the book.
And she wears a lot of very small sized spandex creations.
That's correct. Small sized.
No.
So that's the whole thing. They eat a lot of donuts and fried chicken.
And pizza.
So then I end up hungry when I want. There's a lot of food in those books.
There is.
Then I'm like, the same crap.
With the Lady Sherlock ones that I like. They're constantly talking about tea time. Baked goods. It's very like it makes me hungry all the time.
You're like, well, now I need a scone.
And
a
cup of tea.
I always need a scone and a cup of tea. So
we have scones here. They wouldn't be genuine ones. They're on my freezer. Because my daughter, for a while, that's what she would eat. Like we could get her to eat the damn Schwan scones. Ah. you keep whatever your your autistic child will eat. What you do, you stockpile that. So we still have some because then she was done with it. Then she was done with it, and she moved on. And I think it was like freezer waffles for a while. I'm not saying it's high nutritional value, but this week she is determined to eat an apple every day to be healthy. So.
Love it.
I'm like, great. And I was like, if you could also eat a vegetable off your plate, that would be awesome. Thank you. Hey, and she said, I do. And I said, I've seen you scraping that off afterwards. She's like, I eat a couple. Okay. That's, you know what? That's good enough for me right now. I'm going to do a quick shout out to a mutual friend, and then I'm going to get started because I feel like it'll derail the conversation. But Angela and I were on the Horror Writers Association board together for a while, and a mutual friend of all of us is in the hospital in a coma, so I just wanted to do a shout out to Travis, and he was a guest on here, and so I felt like also our listeners deserve to know that Travis Heerman was in a motorcycle accident, and he has been in a coma now for a couple weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not looking good, but we're all holding out hope of it looking better than the doctors say.
Yeah, so. Exactly.
All right. So I am doing Gypsy Rose Blanchard. Because I'll tell you at the end why I'm doing Gypsy Rose Blanchard this week. On the evening of June 14th, 2015, in Springfield, Missouri, police entered a home while a crowd of concerned neighbors crowded around on the street. They'd been alerted by neighbors and friends that something was going on after two concerning Facebook posts were made on Dee Dee Blanchard's page. The first said, "That bitch is dead." The second said, "I fucking slashed that fat pig and raped her sweet, innocent daughter. Her scream was so fucking loud, LOL, in all caps." So this is what her friends woke up to.
Whoa.
A friend named Kim Blanchard, who was not related and who had met mother and daughter at a speculative convention in the Ozarks, saw this status and tried to call Dee Dee. Knowing she was worried, her husband offered to drive her over and check out the house after they got no answer while trying to call. When they got there, neighbors who had seen the statuses were outside the house, like I'd said, it just like people milling about outside this house. I assume that they'd knocked on the door and I was done all say. That. Yeah. It didn't say, but I'm like, I'm pretty sure one of them was like, you know, knockety knock. So Dee Dee's special van, which allowed her to drive her 19-year-old wheelchair-bound daughter around, was parked outside. When there was no answer at the home, they did call 911. It took hours for the search warrant to go through, so cops couldn't do anything. So they're standing there, too, and they're waiting for this warrant. But they didn't need to stop Kim's husband from climbing in an open window that they found. So they were like, you know what? If you want to, go for it. He didn't go in far, but he was able to report back that all of Dee Dee's daughter's medical equipment and medication were in the house. There was no way they could have gone anywhere without her wheelchair and oxygen. Upon entering the house at 10:45 p.m., police discovered Dee Dee's body. She'd suffered 17 stab wounds to her back while in bed. Her body had clearly been there a couple days. There was no sign of Gypsy Rose, her 19-year-old, with a veritable grocery list of serious illnesses, including muscular dystrophy, asthma, epilepsy, and sleep apnea, plus the vague description of chromosomal defects. She was also known to be intellectually disabled. Moody's saying she had the mental faculties of a 7-year-old. Horrified at what must have happened to the sweet young woman they knew and loved, a search was begun immediately. They did find Gypsy Rose, but her discovery would come with astounding information and change everything her friends and family knew about her entire life up to that point, all 23 years of it. Yeah, that's not a mistake. I did say she was 19, but she'd lived 23 years. So here we go. Yep. Police found Gypsy Rose thanks to a friend of hers, a woman who had been a semi-secret ally through the years, though she hadn't known when police were about to discover. She'd only known that Dee Dee was very protective, overly so it seemed, but it seemed to only be because Gypsy Rose was so incredibly ill and troubled, and it was clearly out of love. This friend, Aaliyah Woodmansey, was aware that Gypsy Rose had a boyfriend her mother didn't know about, one she'd met online at night after Dee Dee went to bed. She'd created a Facebook account in the name Emma Rose, which she used to communicate with Aaliyah, but she also had 4 more accounts under different names. She'd been meeting men online through Christian dating sites, and Aaliyah was able to tell police that Gypsy Rose's latest boyfriend, with whom she'd been in an online relationship for several years, was 25-year-old Nicholas. They were planning on getting married, and yes, he knew Gypsy Rose was in a wheelchair, and it didn't bother him at all. They'd met on a Christian site, just like she'd met her other men. They were both Catholic. They had already picked out names for their children that they were going to have.
Wow.
Gypsy had first mentioned him in late 2014, and at that time she said they'd been dating already for 2 years.
Had they met?
They had not met in person. They had before Dee Dee's death.
Right.
So I'll discuss that in a second. Okay. But they had not met in person in that time. No.
Oh. Yikes.
It turned out Nicholas lived in Wisconsin, as tracked through his IP address by Facebook, because police were able to get into her account and they were able to find this guy and then, yep, track him down. And they were able to arrest him and find Gypsy Rose safe and sound at his home in Big Bend. She was standing on her own 2 feet when they got there. No wheelchair, no oxygen, stubble on her head. Gypsy Rose had been sick since she was born, according to friends and family, including her birth father. Rod Blanchard met Dee Dee in Louisiana when he was 17 years old and she was 24, and she'd gotten pregnant after a couple months of dating. In totality, I think they dated, it said like 4 to 6 months. At 17, he felt the right thing to do was to propose, and when she accepted, they got married. However, before Gypsy Rose was even born, he did realize that he'd made a terrible mistake, that they'd gotten married for the wrong reasons, that he didn't love this woman, and so they split up. Dee Dee moved back in with her parents, and Gypsy Rose was born July 27th, 1991. Though Rod had ended their marriage, he kept in touch with Dee Dee and sent her money every month. This came as a shock to Dee Dee's friends and her daughter, who'd all been told he was an alcoholic drug user, that he'd never paid a dime for his daughter, and they also said that he would mock Gypsy's disabilities. Like, she had said all sorts of awful things about him. Oh. So he told police she'd told him Gypsy Rose had sleep apnea when right there, right after she was born. I think she was like 3 months old when Dee Dee started taking her in and saying she had sleep apnea.
Can you have sleep apnea that young?
That's what I was wondering.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. My son would stop breathing in the middle of the night, but his was because of GERD. So I actually had to sleep with him on my chest every single night because then I could feel if he stopped breathing.
Yeah, I think it probably has something to do with how your kind of nose passages and everything are formed. So I wouldn't see why you couldn't have it as a baby, I guess.
Yeah, because for him, what fixed some of it, because, I mean, again, he grew out of the GERD, but he still had sleep apnea issues where I'd hear him, like, stop breathing, even as, like, a little preteen. But then we got his adenoids and his tonsils out, and that did it for him. And now we're looking at that with my daughter, so... Yeah, it can be something like that. So I don't know, like, how big your tonsils are when you're born, you know? Like, I don't know when all that
no idea
becomes a problem.
We need a medical consultant sometime.
I know. Like, hey, so listen. Medical tests, including sleep monitoring, showed no sign of apnea whatsoever. But Dee Dee was convinced her daughter was suffering cessations in breathing. It kind of makes me, what is the millionaire show where you can, like, phone a friend? We can have, like, a medical expert and just phone him.
Yeah.
All right. Time to phone a friend.
He wants to be a millionaire. Is that the one?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. We need to phone a doctor friend.
And just keep one of, like, multiple experts on there. Cause sometimes we need to maybe speak to a coroner. Like, all right. Just
I could probably find us a nurse, but I don't know that I could reach a coroner.
The next thing Rod heard from Dee Dee was that Gypsy Rose had a chromosomal disorder. Soon after that, it was muscular dystrophy. She had to start using a walker. Then she had gotten so bad she needed to be in a wheelchair. And I think now the stories differ, so I can't say concretely. It sounded like that really the hardcore intervention started when she was 8 or so, but that she'd been taking her to the doctors constantly and claiming these things before then. In 1997, Dee Dee's mother died. Sometime between kindergarten and second grade, Dee Dee started homeschooling Gypsy Rose due to her illnesses, we'll put in quotes. Dee Dee's father got remarried and her new stepmom mysteriously got sick. And again, remember, Dee Dee and Gypsy Rose are living with them. So she developed chronic issues. Her dad and stepmom had seen some things that alarmed them and made them think Dee Dee was doing something to Gypsy Rose and she wasn't as sick as she was letting on. After Dee Dee was busted for some minor crimes and with heat coming from her dad about his grandchild, she took Gypsy Rose and moved across Lake Pontchartrain from them. So I think she was about 2 hours away from now to a town called Slidell. Funnily enough.
I've been through Slidell.
Well, you could wave at their old house.
Had I but known, I would have.
I know. Funnily enough, Dee Dee's stepmother improved after she left. No more chronic illness. Some weed killer was found, and it's thought she was poisoning her stepmother the whole time she was living there. As she'd committed thefts from her family growing up as well, it didn't really come as a surprise that she'd been writing bad checks when living with them. They also suspected that she might have killed her mother in 97 while caring for her by denying her food.
Oh.
Yeah. So you're getting a picture of Dee Dee, which, by the way, I need to say, because I don't think I say it in here anywhere. People who knew Dee Dee now and Gypsy Rose loved them. Dee Dee was this happy woman. They all saw her as this fantastic martyr, this mom of this desperately sick child who stayed positive through it all the time. And like one neighbor was talking about how she would put a movie and play it on the side of the house and invite all the neighborhood kids over to watch the movie and that she'd charge a little bit for some snacks. But that all went to Gypsy's care, so they didn't mind it. But none of these families in this neighborhood could really afford to go to the real movies often. So this was a huge thing. And, you know, it was her just being a giver.
Wow. Like a double faith.
So like everything about her was positive. What newer friends and acquaintances had heard from Dee Dee is that Dee Dee's father, so Gypsy Rose's grandfather, had been abusing her, and that's why she'd had the flea. She even said he'd like put out cigarettes on Gypsy Rose, right? Yeah. So she's really great at making somebody else into the villain. It's basically what this comes down to. Due to Gypsy's health issues, they were able to secure some forms of public assistance. And Dee Dee was able to get public housing for the two to live in. So bear in mind, she was also still secretly getting money from her ex as child support. Mm-hmm. He was giving her $1,200 a month. And I don't even think that was ever legally required. He was just doing that the whole time. And it was being deposited in a New Orleans bank account. So that nobody knew she had. Dee Dee continued taking Gypsy Rose to specialists during this time, reporting issues to Rod on the phone. She went to respected physicians at Tulane and Children's, now telling them her daughter had problems with vision, hearing, chronic ear infections, and that she was having seizures. A doctor did a muscle biopsy as there were no records indicating Gypsy Rose had an official diagnosis of MD, and the biopsy did not find muscular dystrophy. Dee Dee quickly moved on from this doctor and found others to listen to her, because this is what she did. As soon as they started kind of figuring out, she was like, cool, new doctor. And what we found is that there's no communication, that there's just not something like that, unless you're saying, like, if you're in Kaiser, all those doctors within Kaiser are communicating. Yeah. It, but that's really it.
Even today, like, it's not from one place to the next. They share your medical records.
So there's so much you can get away with, right? Mm-hmm. Even for, say, drug seeking or something like that, it's just not going to be documented in a way that it can be avoided. Mm-hmm. Some of these doctors perform surgeries.
Oh.
Because she would kind of do things, we'll say, to rig up her daughter. I can't give you a list of this. I was like, I want to know what surgery she was able to get these people to do with no evidence, you know, but I couldn't, there's no like great list. I'm like, I would just like a list, please. Thank you. But one example was that she said Gypsy had a drooling issue. And so they injected her salivary glands with Botox to stop the overly her drooling so much. But then she went back, she said, it's still a problem. And so they surgically removed her salivary glands. Now, it turns out how she got Gypsy Rose to salivate that much for them to decide they needed to do this was she was applying topical anesthetic to them. And so it would make her salivate.
Oh my gosh.
But here's the thing about having your salivary glands removed is that if there's no saliva, your teeth start to rot. I mean, your saliva is doing work. It's also your first step in digestion. There's certain things that it specifically digests before you're even supposed to. That's why you're supposed to chew it like 30 times, like military style or whatever. They might do 100 times. I don't know. But you're supposed to chew like all your food 30 times or some number like that. I was trying to do that the other day because I'd read it again. And I was like, oh yeah. I was sitting there and I was like, this food is not lasting that many. This will only work on steak. I will do that then. One doctor prescribed seizure medication based on Dee Dee's word. And I was like, I was trying to think about that. And the thing is, my daughter had petite mal until she was like, she was a toddler. And we had just really started the evaluation for her, but there was an evaluation where they sat there and talked to her. And like, she was like, I don't know, two or three, I guess they have her kind of play and they talk to her while she's playing. And that was part of it. And we never really got past that because then they got farther and farther apart and then she stopped having them. So I don't know what you do for that. And I guess unless you can get a child to have a seizure in front of the doctor, perhaps they do take your word for it that it's happening. Yeah. But I feel like there would have been a lot of testing first. And brainwave, you know, like.
Yeah, I would think they could do an overnight, keep her hooked up or have her under observation.
So I'm like, how do you as a doctor but the thing is, she always had an excuse for why it wasn't in the records or whatever. And people trusted her. And I'll post a picture of her. And honestly, she's kind of adorable. You wouldn't look at her and be like, this woman is a terrible child abuser. She was very overweight. But she always is like, you see these pictures and I will post them. And they're both always smiling. Gypsy and Dee Dee. Big, huge, happy smiles. Dee Dee was happy. She was getting all this attention and all this stuff from making her daughter sick. And of course, she'd go to the emergency room, say such and such had happened, and they do whatever there too. So anytime she even had a cough, they said it was off to the emergency room. Then in 2005, Hurricane Katrina hit southern Louisiana. Slidell was located there next to the lake, and their housing was destroyed. She had pictures of the rubble that the house had turned into. Dee Dee took Gypsy Rose to a shelter where someone recommended Missouri as a good place to live. The news took up their story and they were given aid. They were actually flown to Missouri because here's this story of a mom and her heavily disabled child. And now they're in a shelter and their home is, oh my God. And the public was just like, well, we must help. And so sure enough, right? So yeah, they flew them to Missouri and then they were given public housing. And then like, she was able to go to the doctors and say, well, all of the records were lost in the hurricane. They were destroyed. Yep. There are no records, but I can tell you what she has. So here she has muscular dystrophy again, right? Because now she can just be like, yeah, that's why she's in the wheelchair. And I'm like, didn't they look? I'm sorry. I have been a caretaker. Like, if you cannot walk and you are in a wheelchair, and you absolutely, because some people are in a wheelchair but can walk part, right? You're like, they can, but it is best if they not, or they can't much. But things happen to your muscles. They atrophy. If you cannot walk, how were they looking at this child and not seeing atrophied muscles and falling for this? Like, what the hell was up with these doctors? Never go to a doctor in Louisiana or Missouri is what I'm saying, I guess. Like, I can't, unless you want to lie about what you have. So she got a clean slate and she got all these new treatments and she got what she wanted and what she'd been seeking from these other doctors that were testing. Then Habitat for Humanity built them a house in 2008.
Oh my gosh.
Yep. There's a big thing. I will be posting a picture of them hammering in a nail, like Dee Dee hammering in a nail with the gypsy right there for their little photo op. Now that they'd hit the news, they had public support. Dee Dee told people that Gypsy Rose had leukemia as a child and was having to endure ongoing operations and that she still had to be medicated for it sometimes. So she shaved her head.
So that gosh. Now she has leukemia?
Yep.
Oh my God.
Now she has leukemia. Dee Dee changed her name like frequently throughout this. And so her name wasn't even actually Dee Dee. I just felt it was easiest to just go by that name.
To pick one and go with
it. Yeah, I think her birth name was like Claudine, and then she would change the spelling of it to disguise it.
Oh my God.
And then she, like her last name, her married last name, but she kept it after, was Blanchard. Well, she added an E onto that at some point. Like her I was like, your big disguise is to add an E to the end of your first and last name. That's great. They'll never find you. I could find you with a simple internet search if that's what you did. Gypsy Rose, who by this time was fully in that wheelchair, bald, like I said, on oxygen and being tube fed.
Oh,
yeah. She basically lived off Ensure and stuff like that for a long time. Was given a meeting with Miranda Lambert through Make-A-Wish. She was given multiple trips to Disney World by different charities and other. And she received other benefits given to cancer patients and disabled kids. Here's the thing. When my son was in preschool, one of his friends got leukemia. So she was also a preschooler. And like you get, there's a lot of cool things they give these kids. Like we went to an annual party up in Denver with them. That was just, it was an entire gala event put on for children. It was amazing. There was food, there were limo rides, there were bouncies inside this building. There was an ongoing concert the whole time. There are what were they called? The local roller derby team was there because Savannah got like a stuffed animal signed by them and they gave her her own name and stuff like that when we were there. So, and there's a camp here in Colorado for kids with cancer that's free to the parent. There are so many benefits people don't know about, but of course, when you have a child with cancer, that's the least that you can, right? Mm-hmm. But she was getting these. She was getting these resources from people that then other kids weren't getting. Mm-hmm. Before the Make-A-Wish house, Habitat house was completed, they had lived in several Ronald McDonald houses. They even got free flights to places. So like there's a picture of them in the back of a small plane. It's just them, right? And the pilot.
Wow.
I imagine like some of those were them paying for them to go because she would go out of town for some of the medical care. So, I mean, there's another way to get them behind you. Friends and neighbors did report that they would disappear. And then Dee Dee would come back and she'd be like, yeah, we were in such and such getting this medical treatment. Throughout this time, Dee Dee was still reporting to Rod and he was actually talking to Gypsy on the phone. Like this, her birth father, who everybody thought was out of the picture, like Gypsy was talking to him, but she couldn't say anything. Like her mom was always there. Mm-hmm. And that friend that I mentioned earlier, Leah, who told him about the boyfriend, she said she only time that they were able to talk alone was in the middle of the night via that Facebook. If they were there in person, Dee Dee was there always. She was never, Gypsy did not get to hang out with kids without Dee Dee right there. You have to protect your supply there. Mm-hmm. You can't let anything get up. he was sending that child support, but he was also sending various gifts, and she'd request things. She'd be like, hey, we need a new TV. And he'd buy a TV and he would send the TV to them. He had actually gotten remarried and he had other kids with his new wife. And even after Gypsy's 18th birthday, he chose to keep sending that child support. While everybody thought this man was trash, he was like, she's still disabled. I'm still going to send support. Like, he actually sounds like a pretty
deep. He really sounds like a stand-up guy. Yes.
And up until she was 10, Rod had actually been getting to visit her in person back, you know, when they still lived in Louisiana. And he has all these pictures. He has these pictures of taking her to the beach. They would go to the Special Olympics together. She won some honorary thing there one time. Oh, God. So again, not in the picture, terrible person. Nope, he was able to like hand over pictures to the reporters. Like, yeah, here, this is when she was coming out. Mm-hmm. And of course, it was so much easier for things to go downhill more once they lived in a different state.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he did try and visit her. He tried repeatedly to visit. And what would happen is he'd make the arrangements. And then Dee Dee would always find a way to have something come up, some emergency. They had to go somewhere. And then he'd have to cancel. And they'd be like, okay, we'll figure out another time. But again, he did have two other kids. So it's not like he'd be like, cool, I'll come right when that one's done then. So that's why he wasn't able to see her, if people are wondering. Dee Dee ensured that he and if he'd suspected something, he just thought that she was also this great mom that was taking care of the daughter. And he only got what information she gave him.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he had no reason to suspect. If he'd suspected, I'm sure he could have just shown up. And that's what he should have done if he'd known. But otherwise, you're not going to spring that on somebody.
Because that's not your first thought. Oh, I think my wife is making this up.
Yeah.
That just isn't, no, you're worried about your child. So you're not thinking about,
you're like, okay, yeah, report back to me. Like, let me know what comes of this. And then he'd worry about her. And then, yeah. So he learned with the rest of the region, because I don't know how international or like that news was, but I know it did hit the regional news. Like, he learned that she could stand up. That's when he learned, is when they had found Gypsy after Dee Dee had been killed. And there was his daughter walking on the news. And that brings us back around to 2015 when Dee Dee got murdered. When police found Gypsy Rose, she told them that she wasn't sick, that her mother had been making it all up. Dee Dee had even been shaving her hair, like I said before, to pretend for those cancer treatments. How much she knew about her own illnesses was kind of tricky. Like, she was very confused. She did think that legitimately some of those things were real, but mm-hmm. she also knew her mom was doing some things or saying some things that weren't true, but she didn't always know that. She had come into adulthood and been like, you know, wait a second. With all the medications and interventions, she likely thought, I mean, here's the thing. I know, for example, seizure medications. I was put on some seizure medications. There's a lot of medications that have multiple uses.
Yes.
I've never had seizures, but I was put on them for the permanent migraine mm-hmm. I have when I was still letting them throw drugs at me. And some of those things have such awful side effects that you might as well, if you didn't know better, you'd probably think that was an illness, you know, like they did terrible things to me. It's why I can't be on them. And so I'm just thinking like, just the medication she was on and the stuff mom was doing. And she probably did feel genuinely sick in mm-hmm. a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. You know? And if she had a rep for poisoning people, who knows what she was like actually putting in her food. Or that's a
huge thing with, mm-hmm. with mother Munchausen's by proxy, right? Yeah. Which we'll go into later, is slipping that poison into the one kid. I just kind of scrolled through some other ones. Like one kid, his mom had killed him with table salt. Like you can kill somebody with table salt. So, but poisoning is the big thing, right? Uh-huh. And what is that? Sixth sense. She's putting like antifreeze or something in the little girl's soup. I don't remember, but because it's sweet. Antifreeze uh-huh. is sweet. So anyway, you never know. And I don't think we ever will know. She did know she could walk though. And she did know eventually that she could eat, but her mom had to fed her up and through a pretty high age. When interviewed, again, she was confused about what was real. So it was kind of, there was a lot of discovery in her interviews, you know, with police and with journalists, and she was discovering it right along with them. And she had also truly thought she was 19. Her mom had multiple birth certificates. She had fake birth certificates. I'm like, how did this woman figure out how to be like such a great criminal? And it nobody knew she was 23 till her dad gave the original birth certificate to the police. And then she was like, shit, I'm 23.
Surprise.
And she had done it by degrees because there was one story about something that had happened. And at that point, she was only fudging her age by 2 years. And then by this time, it's 4 years there at the end. And Gypsy Rose was so tiny, it was kind of easy to say she was younger than she was.
Well, because she had to have been malnourished.
Right.
Yes.
Right. I say it later, but I think she was like 4'11" and maybe 100 pounds. So, and here's the thing. When she hooked up with Nicholas, he was 6 years older than her as far as they knew.
Okay.
Right? But it turns out he was actually only like 1 or 2 years older than her in reality once she knew her real age.
Wow.
And so the way her mother deceived her about, for example, her hair. So she was shaving her hair, but she was telling Gypsy Rose it's because the medication will make her lose it anyway. So we might as well just shave it now so that it's nice and even and it doesn't look bad. So that's why she thought she genuinely would have lost her hair. So a lot of these things, her mom was just so deceptive and she was really good at twisting something. And so Gypsy Rose believed, right? And again, this is her mom. This is the person who's taken care of her whole life. Mm-hmm. So let's be clear on that too. Like, it takes a while to doubt a parent. And so she did think she had leukemia. She did think that was a real thing. When police started to investigate further, they discovered that Gypsy had been trying to get free of her mother in those relationships she was trying to do online. She was trying to like abscond with the men, you know, ultimately was the plan. And in fact, at one of the conventions she'd attended in 2011, because her mom allowed this because she got her wigs. And so she had all these fun wigs and she fit in at a sci-fi and fantasy convention see, because that's one really inclusive place in a lot of ways, at least in more recent years. And so she could be there in her wheelchair with her wig and it was great. And nobody noticed anything weird about her. And so she did get to go to those. And I guess she kind of did let her go a little bit free in there because she had one of the men meet her at this convention in 2011. And they went up to his room and they had sex. And Gypsy's mother showed up, couldn't find her, but everybody knew because again, she talked to everybody. She was friendly with everybody. And so they were like, well, she was with this guy. And anyway, the hotel staff knew her. They were able to tell her where she was eventually. And she gets up to this guy's room and she knocks on the door and she has, of course, the fake birth certificate, and she tells him that, hey, you're having sex with a 15-year-old, and if you ever contact her again, I'm going to the police.
And she's actually 19.
Yep.
Oh,
but I will say this: he was 35.
Okay, that's
no matter what.
Okay, that's creepy.
Pretty grody.
So yeah. Creepy. Yeah.
So honestly, I'm not sad that one ended, but it was an example of her mom's overreach, and it was. So Dee Dee takes her home and she destroyed her computer. She destroyed her, like physically destroyed, beat everything into smithereens, her phone and her computer. She chained Gypsy up to her bed and she put bells on like the windows and doors or something that would fall and make noise if Gypsy were to move. And then one article, and so I only saw this in one article, so I'm not going to say it's true or not. Apparently in an interview, Gypsy said that also during this time, her mom used a dog leash on her and she had the other end like around her wrist or something so that if Gypsy even moved, it would wake her up. So
that's insane.
Pretty extreme punishment. And in interviews, she has said that her mom did stuff like withholding food from her if she was being punished for something and that sort of thing. But this is when she said, you know what? Like, I want to know why I can't have friendships and relationships with people. And I want to know what's going on here and why my mom is so controlling. And that's also when she started questioning how sick she was. So that was 2011. That was 3 years before. That's when she finally went, something's going on. Mm. Gypsy and Nicholas had discussed getting rid of her mother for about a year ahead, but they had first tried to get Dee Dee to meet him and like him. She was like, maybe she'll let me just, you know, we'll be in love. We'll get married and mama let me go live with him. In March 2015, they had a chance meeting at a movie theater. Chance meeting at a movie theater. He's from out of state, where Dee Dee had taken Gypsy to see Cinderella. Gypsy had dressed up like the title character, and Nicholas had dressed up as Prince Charming. She said she needed to go to the bathroom, and her mom let her go on her own. and Nicholas met her, and that's when they A, met in person, and B, had sex for the first time.
Wow.
In the movie bathroom? In the bathroom at the movie theater.
Oh.
Okay. I mean, understand that since she was really 23, like all these years of suppressed.
Right.
She had normal urges.
She probably didn't know what an appropriate way to express them was because nobody had modeled that for her.
No.
Nor an opportunity, right? Secret in the bathroom was like probably the only way she could do it.
Right. Like she couldn't, it's not like you could sneak into her house and do it, but I mean, they could have tried, but so however they arrange it, they arrange to meet each other and Gypsy introduces them to her mom and her mom hates him from the get-go.
Of course.
She does not like it. Right. Right. And so that plan didn't work. On the day of the murder, he snuck in and he murdered Dee Dee after she'd gone to bed. Gypsy said she hid in another room and listened to it happen, although she also said she was like covering her ears once it started. And she, when he got there, she handed him, I think, rope or the duct tape and the knife and like a mask or something. It was like, or gloves. Sorry. She handed him gloves, the knife, and duct tape when he got there. And then she went and she hid while he did it. They then took all the money her mother had. She had a safe, and in it was about $4,000, and they took off for Big Bend, where Nicholas lived. First, they went to his hotel room that he'd stayed in. They mailed the knife to his house so that if they were caught on the run, they would not have the weapon on him, which I actually was like, okay. There are other ways you could have disposed of that.
You could throw it in a dumpster. You could throw it off a bridge. You could bury it. You could. Why mail it to yourself?
They were trying to be clever because they knew not to have it on them, but good try. Good try. Charges were pressed for first-degree murder for both of them, but when Gypsy's state-appointed attorney started doing his research and started getting her medical records, that's when all of this really broke loose. It quickly became obvious that Gypsy Rose hadn't had any of the problems her mother had told others about. Her medical records had not, in fact, been destroyed in Louisiana. And what those showed were all those negative tests for all the things she'd been claiming since then. There was even a doctor who had written down he suspected Munchausen by proxy. But again, there wasn't like a clear way to do anything about it. And as soon as he started doubting her, she had moved on anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So again, that's something, there's so many things we could improve, right? In society, in general. And the other doctor's notes, because again, she had been saying she had the mentality of a 7-year-old, that she was intellectually disabled. And I'm sure, to me, that's, don't listen to what she says. She has the mind of a 7-year-old. She's going to say things that don't jive with what I'm saying. Same reason she pulled out her to school.
Mm-hmm.
If she'd been in school, something would have happened. She probably would have stood up at some point. She probably would have done something that told people that she wasn't in the position, so that she isolated her, right? Like a real abuser does. But the doctor's notes would say stuff like, she's really bright. She's a great vocabulary, you know, stuff like that. And so it's a good thing they take those types of notes, I guess. According to Psych Central, Munchausen syndrome is, quote, someone deliberately and persistently faking their physical or mental illness symptoms or magnifying signs or symptoms of an illness. Munchausen by proxy is when, quote, the person shows this behavior towards someone else like a child. Someone in their care, at least. It's now actually referred to in the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, as factitious disorder. I didn't know that. I didn't know they changed the name.
Oh, okay.
I mean, they also got rid of Asperger's in that one. So here we are. But it's factitious disorder and factitious disorder imposed on someone else.
Hmm.
I was like, really? Just say by proxy. Come on.
Yeah.
That's such a weird way. You just made it so awkward. So I'm going to continue saying Munchausen because A, I like it. B, I take issue with the newest DSM for various reasons. And C, it's just better and it's easier to say than factitious disorder.
And people know what it is.
So. Right. And that's the thing. I'm like, I didn't know it had changed and I'm all in with psych and have like a early degree and you know, and I didn't know it changed because I'm not reading the DSM. The criteria for being diagnosed with Munchausen by proxy is falsely presenting or causing, and these are directly from, so we'll just say they're all quotes instead of quoting, unquoting, falsely presenting or causing physical or mental health symptoms in someone else with the intent of deception, authoritatively and falsely presenting another, adult, child, or pet to others as physically or mentally impaired, The deceptive behavior occurs even when there's no obvious gain or benefit. No other mental health condition can explain these behaviors. And it goes on with the following characteristics: extensive but inconsistent medical history in the patient, perhaps with symptoms that don't seem to correlate. Frequent cycles of reporting improvement and worsening of the symptoms. Tendency to evade questions and change providers when a health professional is exploring causes other than a diagnosable condition. Eagerness to have multiple medical examinations or procedures performed on the proxy. Intense emotional reactions when a health professional doesn't provide or confirm a diagnosis. Development of new symptoms when test results don't lead to a diagnosis, and long list of medical visits and hospital stays. It kind of freaked me out about some of these because I'm finally getting the doctor finally referred my daughter for an issue she's had for a long time that's getting worse, and that landed us in the ER this week. And I'm like, oh, great. Like, somebody's going to think that I've got freaking Munchausen's because, you know, I basically had to fight. I had to fight to even get her to her evaluation for autism because her doctor with a list of why I thought that autism was a real possibility said it could just be anxiety. Ugh. And I was like, what?
Listening.
Like, two things on this list could be anxiety. But anyway, like, some of those are pretty like, yeah, I'm pretty sure I would have gotten upset.
If you're talking about a female, it can always be hysteria.
Yeah.
I have the vapors.
That's it. Oh, goodness me.
Anxiety is the modern version of saying you have hysteria.
Right?
Probably.
Now the DSM also shows a counter to Munchausen, and that's malingering. Malingering is when someone pretends to have, quote, a medical condition for gaining money, fame, or notoriety, end quote. With Dee Dee dead, there was no way to tell for sure. They couldn't evaluate her. They could evaluate through her actions.
Right.
They couldn't speak to her, though. So they couldn't say if she had Munchausen by proxy or was a malingerer. But Gypsy Rose was shown the information from the DSM, and she said her mom met all of the characteristics of Munchausen. And in her earlier years, she wasn't benefiting with fame or fortune. That's the thing. That all did come later, and she was doing that before it was actually bringing her any sort of reward.
Right.
So it does sound like she actually had Munchausen. And then it seems, I'm like, could it be both at the end? Because then she was. They were profiting. They were getting flights. They were getting Disney World. They were getting housing. So of course she was going to keep doing that.
Yeah, it's like positive reinforcement of the behavior. There's exactly. Even more good, you know, you're going to get even more attention and rewards now. So
yeah. Mm-hmm. And I will say that experts who have looked back and gotten it spoken to Gypsy Rose, they do feel pretty confident it was actually Munchausen. By the way, I always want to call it Munchausen's, and that's not actual. That's not real. It's just Munchausen, singular.
Ah.
And also, there really was a Baron von Munchausen. Like, you guys saw that movie, right?
Mm-hmm. I did see that movie.
Yes. It was quite entertaining, and I feel I should watch it again. But the syndrome is based off of a real dude.
Hmm.
Yeah, which is fun. And now I want to look him up. Interestingly, an article pointed out that it was common for the 1% of people suffering the syndrome to have a medical background, and that sleep apnea is often one of the first disorders they suggest. It's probably kind of easy, right? I guess. Dee Dee did have a stint as a nurse's aide before she had Gypsy. Yeah. It's also far more common in women, which makes sense to me. Now, this isn't from an expert or an official. I feel that makes sense because women are often the caretakers.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But also women are often the ones nobody's taking care of. So you get attention by saying you have these things that you don't have. Like, it makes sense to me that women would be the ones most often having it.
It does.
Dudes almost always have someone freaking taking care of them. Like, wife, mother, whatever. Gypsy Rose stated that her mother would squeeze her hand really hard if she said or did anything to people that went against what she was saying about her illnesses. So, like, if she was out there, she had to be really careful about how she talked. So this is why she was part of the deception. A lot of people turned on her saying, well, you were part of it too. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, but she was trained to be from, like,
yeah.
And she literally, like, basically her life was on the line. I mean, who wouldn't be scared in that scenario? If you do something wrong, you know you're going to get punished and you're going to get sicker. You know?
And who was teaching her how even normal society works? Nobody. So, yeah. And then when they got back to the privacy of the house, she would be physically punished. again, like I mentioned earlier, with withholding food from her for a while, that would happen. But she would also get struck with a hand or a hanger, she said. Like mommy dearest for sure.
So withholding food would be neglect. Being hit with a hanger would be abuse. Being spanked with a hand would be punishment.
Yeah.
Sorry, I just had to do the mandated reporter training. And I'm like, wait, I know this one. But yeah, that is, Jesus.
In short, Gypsy Rose had spent her entire life being mentally and physically abused by her mother with the aid of physicians. Like, I was looking at this, and what popped into my head was just, like, she was medically raped for much of her life. Her body was violated. She had no autonomy whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Like, I just, and the mom was so convincing and so well-liked that so few people thought there was a problem, and she got away with this for 23 years.
Oh, my God.
So, but then Gypsy had got her boyfriend to kill her mother. And so a crime was committed. She did a wrong thing. She took a plea bargain for second degree murder. I will say, too, that the prosecutor actually refused to seek the death penalty in this case for either of them because of the situation and how unusual it was. And, you know, and so I can respect that because I'm not a fan of a lot of the prosecutors and the DAs and stuff around. They're dirty here in Colorado Springs. I can't talk about anywhere else. I've seen a lot of gross stuff down here. But, and they're honest, they're so often driven to get the biggest get that they can get, right? And they will do dishonest things to get it. And so to me, I found that I found respect for this person for going, you know what, this is a really shit situation. Let's take this off the table from the beginning. And they were all for like the second degree for her too. Like nobody wanted to take this girl down. Mm-hmm. It's what it comes down to is like, okay, you did commit a crime. We do have to do something about that. Her plea bargain got her the minimum sentence of 10 years. That was the minimum she could get for second degree, 85% of which had to be served before she could be released. And they used the time since she had been arrested to count toward that sentence as well. So again, I feel like they were doing their best to try and not do as big a disservice as they could have and were doing to her, right? Like they did what they could in their power. Nicholas was not given a plea bargain because he wasn't being abused, right? When he was psychologically evaluated, he was found to have an IQ of 82 and to be on the autism spectrum. He and Gypsy both stated he was the one who'd stabbed her mom. And she said she did at one point mention him killing her mom to free her. So she got on, part of her plea bargain did not require her to get on to stand against him, but she did take the stand and she said, you know what? I asked him to do it. You know, this is on me too. Like let's be clear here. However, it's not 100%. There's really a lot of differentiation online about who initiated the plot. Because at one point, too, she said, I didn't think he'd actually do it. Like, when it all came down to it, I didn't think he'd follow through. I didn't think he could actually kill my mom. And before that killing and after their whole little, let's just let them meet and she'll like you and we can get married, she'd thrown out another option. And she said he never responded one way or the other if he was willing. And that was, she wanted him to get her pregnant. And then her mom would have to let her go. And I was like, nah, sis. I think she either would have given you something to make you lose that baby or she would have had a second baby to abuse and say it was sick, you know, like but I also understand why she thought, you know,
I don't think her mother would have let her carry it, but
right. I don't think it would have gone through, but because even if it did, then she would have gotten more sympathy though.
Then there would have been a big public. How did you let this happen to your daughter?
That's
if your daughter can't walk.
Right. How did she get
how
pregnant?
Did she? Yeah. How did this happen?
He was ultimately found guilty of first-degree murder and armed criminal action is the other charge. He got a life sentence for the murder and 25 years for the armed criminal action to be served concurrently. It has been argued that he was not mentally competent to stand trial and face these charges, but to me, as somebody who is possibly on that same spectrum and whose daughter is officially, I think he was a competent adult living his own life. So I don't know how far that goes there. But I'll let folks make up their own minds on that one. Dee Dee's family flushed her ashes down the toilet. her parents after her death.
What?
Wow.
That's they felt well. Her they parents? Found out her Dee Dee's parents flushed. Were so disgusted they did not attend her funeral. When they were given her ashes, they flushed them down the toilet. She is not only dead, she is dead to them.
Yeah.
Because of what she did, well, and also possibly to her mother and her stepmother.
Yeah, exactly.
So they were like, they're done. She's
reasonable. That sounds reasonable to me.
It does to me too. I was like, you know what? That's
all they had to do, right? Like they have no outlet.
No.
Damn. That's just, I mean, they could have just not picked up the ashes.
I think it was more satisfying to flush them out of the toilet, frankly.
Wow, that's just, I mean, for me to be like, damn, I mean, I am a petty, vindictive bitch. And I'm like, God damn, they flushed her ashes.
And also bear in mind, she had committed crimes against them by theft when she was living with them, even aside from murder and attempted murder and abuse of their grandchild. Like she was a monster. And they are, of course, supportive of Gypsy Rose. So just to be clear there. And also, of course, her father and stepmother, Gypsy's father and stepmother have been there for her, too. So I will say that the ex-husband has been very, very polite and hasn't ripped her apart. And he said something about, you know, I think she just kind of, she told one lie and then it just kept building and she was trapped by her own, you know, like he was very political, sympathetic, and he has never said anything truly nasty about her that turned up anywhere. I just think he's this nice, aw shucks guy. Right?
He's like kind of a gem.
Right.
Yeah.
And so it's like, okay. And of course they are supporting her as well. In Chillicothe, I don't know how to say it, correctional center, Gypsy Rose actually gained weight. Her lawyer said, I have never had one of my clients go in and come out looking healthier than when they went in.
Yeah.
They lose weight because the food sucks. She gained weight and her skin cleared and her hair grew back and she came out in so much better shape
than when she
went in. And he was just like, if that doesn't tell you the level of abuse she was suffering and what her was like, what would?
I was thinking that like going to jail might be a better environment than the one she was living in.
Yeah. No. And she said it too. She was like, man, this is amazing. So I have a quote from her. I feel like I'm more free in prison than with living with my mom because now I'm allowed to just live like a normal woman. And in addition to that, other places, she was like, yeah, I get 3 meals a day. Like I get to chew my food. I'm not stuck in a wheelchair to convince other people. And yeah, it was such a better place for her. She got to be an adult. And of course, the reason I cover this right now is because Gypsy Rose has officially been released from prison as of December 28th, 2023. She got married while in prison in 2022, and she is now out and living with her husband. I could not find how they met or how any of that happened. I'm assuming an online relationship as well. There have been a ton of social media posts. I've seen them all over the place. She showed up to a restaurant and that restaurant took a picture of her saying she was there and put it on their social media. So I'm a little concerned about the abuse she's going to get in that way of people using her.
Yeah.
So, she has a book that's coming out actually this month, I think, about it's her memoir and she wrote it in prison. She hopes to educate others about Munchausen by proxy to hopefully save other victims from going through what she did. She's hoping to get a bunch of followers on her social media. So I did choose to leave her handle basically on one of the images I'll post because she does want that attention. Otherwise, I would have cut that out. And yeah, she wants people to follow her so that they can learn so that because she feels the more people that know about this, the harder it is to get away with it. Right.
Yeah.
She has stated that she fully understands she committed a crime and that it was necessary for her to serve her time for it. On Dr. Phil, she said, quote, I have to pray to forgive my mother, but right now the hardest thing is to forgive myself. And in a People interview, she said, quote, nobody will ever hear me say I'm glad she's dead or I'm proud of what I did. I regret it every single day. So just to be clear, this is not a sociopath we're talking about here. It was still her mom. Mm-hmm. As part of her parole, she is not allowed to contact Nicholas ever again. So all I can say is, I hope that all these people are helping her and that they understand that she's been through massive trauma and that she has never, ever, ever learned how to live in society as a normal person.
Yeah.
And I hope they take that into account. And I hope this dude that married her is not some piece of shit who was chasing publicity or something like that. Yeah. So I don't know. I was seeing her popping up and it concerns me that she won't be cared for the way she needs to be. So I hope that she's also getting help. Sources, Psych Central, BuzzFeed News. It was a specific article from somebody who had interviewed her and all these people, because otherwise I wouldn't be quoting BuzzFeed News. Today, I think they actually a documentary was made off of it. So today, BBC World News, USA Today, NPR people, and Wikipedia.
I started seeing people saying, okay, we've released her. Now what about the Menendez brothers?
I saw that as well. And so I think I might be covering the Menendez brothers next time.
Because I'm like, I know you say the Menendez brothers. I have the image in my head. I remember nothing. I don't remember any details about the case.
I will say that the reason people think they should be freed is because it has come out that the father was sexually abusing them. But also the father was like, what is it? The Menudo, you know, the musical group. Uh-huh. He was some part of that. He was the one leading them or whatever. And there's apparently a sexual abuse there as well. And the mother knew that they were being sexually abused is the claim. And that is why she had to be killed too. But that's all I can remember. So I might cover it next time.
Be a happy February.
Right.
Happy Valentine's Day.
So the pressure's on you to bring something a little lighter to close out that Menendez episode.
That's right.
Great.
That's right. No pressure.
No pressure.
Do you enjoy going to the grocery store? If so, this message is not for you. But if you're like me and procrastinate going to the store, Instacart is a fantastic option to ensure you no longer have to. Save yourself a trip and go through Instacart, where you can get a delivery through a personal shopper in as little as 1 hour. My experiences have been great so far, with my personal shopper texting me before substituting another product, letting me know when they were on their way to my house, and letting me know it had been delivered, all via text. If you click on our affiliate link in the show notes or on our website, you get free delivery on your first order over $35, and you help out our show at the same time. It's the perfect time to give it a try.
All right, so now we're going to go over to Angela.
Yes, so I'm covering today the kidnapping and murder of Jacob Wetterling, which was something I very vividly remember, and I'll tell you why. So I'll kind of set the stage for you. It was 1989. I was 11 years old in sixth grade. And, you know, it was the 80s. So, you know, kind of externally, it was a really kind of carefree neon time. I was living in Grand Forks, North Dakota, in a small town that was near the Minnesota border. You know, I was like listening to Paula Abdul, Janet Jackson, New Kids on the Block. I think I had an NKOTB slap bracelet just to really. you know, I was watching like Saved by the Bell, Doogie Howser MD, those kind of things. And I was probably snacking on like Lunchables and bubble tape. Okay. So it was like a silly time for kids. You know, I'm 11. I'm also a Gen Xer, kind of on the line of being millennial. So I'm what we call an Xennial. I think you are too. and so we were real latchkey kids, right? Very little parental supervision. Mm-hmm. I took care of myself and my little sister after school, probably younger than anyone would allow these days.
Oh, yeah.
I could go wherever I wanted pretty much any time. And one of the places I went pretty regularly, I lived in a trailer park that was a little shady in retrospect. But at the time, it didn't like make my radar that it was shady, really. But there was a gas station, a mini mart, about like half a mile to a mile away. And it was a very regular occurrence that me and my sister, or me and my friends, would walk to that gas station to like buy candy with our pocket change. Uh-huh. So that was kind of like my life. So Jacob Wetterling was also 11. He was 2 weeks younger than me. Ooh. So very similar in age, very close by. So that's kind of why I like vividly remember his abduction. It took place in Minnesota, just a couple hours away from me across the border. And it was really the first time I can remember being aware that kids like me could be in danger from adults. I was like, oh no, like an adult might want me for some reason and they could just snatch me up off the side of the road. Like, what is happening? So that's kind of why it's so solidified in my memory. And I think for a lot of other kids my age too.
I get that. And because there was another Heather Dawn Church here in Colorado was, it wasn't my realization because I had had an attempted kidnap on me before that. So I knew, but when you think about it, here we are, we're Gen X, right? And we're latchkey kids and we're used to adults really not paying attention to us. But on the flip side, we're being told some adults really want us, you know, like what?
It's mind blowing.
Yeah. Most adults are paying no attention, but a few adults are paying way too much.
Right.
Right. The ones that shouldn't be might be. So, yes. You know, be very scared and careful. So let's talk about what actually happened with Jacob Utterling. So it was Sunday, October 22nd, 1989. And it was just after 9 p.m. And Jacob, again, he was 11. And his younger brother, Trevor, who was 10. And his friend, Aaron, who was 11. We're biking home from the Tom Thumb convenience store in St. Joseph, Minnesota, where they had gone to rent a movie, a video. So just such an innocent thing. They're going with their friends. It should be safe, right?
Yeah.
And a man in a stocking cap and armed with a gun came out of a driveway and ordered the boys to throw their bikes in the ditch and to lie down face down on the ground. He then asked each boy his age. And Jacob's brother was told to run toward the nearby wooded area and to not look back or else he would be shot. So he was told to go. Then the man demanded to see the faces of the two remaining boys. And he picked Jacob and told Aaron to run away, threatening him again that he will shoot him in the back if he looks back. And this was the last time Jacob was seen alive by anyone other than his captor. So obviously the whole thing was truly shocking locally, but also nationally. Despite extensive searches and police investigation, Jacob was never found until much later. So I just remember it being like everywhere on the news, everyone talking about it. How could such a thing happen? And I think everyone also thought it would be like solved right away. And so then when it wasn't, that made it even worse, right? It's like, okay, well, we really have no idea what happened. And obviously the worst possible thing for his parents to go through this and his family, his brother, his friends. So in the interim, I'm eventually going to tell you what did happen with Jacob and who did it. But since we didn't find out till much later, essentially as time passes, Jacob's parents, Jerry and Patty, formed the Jacob Wetterling Foundation, which is an advocacy group for children's safety. And in 1994, the federal Jacob Wetterling Act was passed, which was actually the first law to institute a state sex offender registry, because it was kind of on the radar that that's maybe what had happened with Jacob and why he was taken. So that's really where that first sex offender registry came from. And then later, that law had been amended several times, pretty famously by Megan's Law in 96. And then also by the Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act in 2006. Yes. So two other really famous cases of child abduction. So then now we're going to jump ahead to 2010. So it's been 21 years since Jacob's abduction. When Joy Baker, a Minnesota true crime blogger, citizen sleuth, and mother of two boys, started blogging about Jacob. She remembered the case. She was around at the time. It had always stuck in her mind. And she was just kind of like obsessed that there must be more that could be done and that this case could be solved. She was like convinced there was enough to solve this case. So she'd found out about a case where another boy, Jared Shearl, had been abducted and molested at the age of 12 in a neighboring town. And that was just 10 months before Jacob's disappearance. And Cheryl, the boy, he had also spent years consumed with finding his attacker and bringing him to justice. So Joy starts combing through microfilm archives and newspapers, and she learns of other reports of children, too, who had been stalked and threatened by a masked man with a gun. So then she contacted Cheryl, who was now 37, to let him know about the connection she'd found. And he had also been doing this work, so he was very willing to talk about it, wanted to know what she had found, wanted to solve his own case. Investigators weren't really taking them seriously at first, but then they got more attention when they were interviewed on a show on CNN in 2014. So they were kind of like making national news for this new investigation that they were doing, which I think is really interesting, kind of also comment on our modern times and the importance of citizen sleuths, right? Uh-huh. Of these people who kind of, you can kind of, while law enforcement did get some criticism over how they handled this case, which I'll talk about. Also, there are some things they missed. Additionally, they don't necessarily have time to look at the minutiae of every single unsolved case, right? But these citizen sleuths can really like lock in on something and make it their priority and discover things police would never kind of have the time to connect the dots. So I just think that's really interesting. So then after the CNN appearance, investigators do start taking another look at the series of attempted and actual child molestations that had occurred in the area in the 2 years preceding Jacob's abduction. So between the summer of 1986 and the spring of 1987, five teenage boys were attacked, but no one was ever arrested. The authorities re-interviewed some of the victims again, and that man, Gerald Cheryl, he actually like actively encouraged these other people to come forward and work with police and was like, hey, I'm a victim too. Like, I know this is hard to talk about, but we really need to help. We need to do this in order to solve our own cases and to get closure and potentially help others. So he really actively encouraged these people to come forward. And the police also worked with Joy on all the things she had kind of connected the dots and put together. So after 5 months of research and interviews, the investigators did become convinced that these attacks were not random and that the culprit could also be connected to the abduction of Jacob. So in addition to kind of thinking these might be connected to Jacob, investigators also renewed their efforts on Cheryl's case. So his crime that was committed when he was 12. And in May of 2014, they discovered that previously unidentified DNA from Cheryl's crime scene was a match with a man named Danny James Heinrich. You'll notice he has three names.
Right.
The true crime world always know what that means.
Yep.
So he had actually been questioned by the FBI about Jacob Wetterling in December of 1989. And they did take a DNA sample from him at that time. But he was not charged with the crime and he was released. So now his DNA matches that from the Cheryl case, but the statute of limitations had expired on that case, which is bullshit.
Agreed.
Should be no statute of limitations, but we all know sexual assault and molestation do have statute of limitations. Even though they
yep. And often even get the minor punishment compared yep. to things that are so much less
right.
victimizing, right?
Like traumatizing a victim for their whole lives, but even if it is within the statute of limitations, maybe you get a year in jail or
oh yeah,
something like that. So,
but don't have pot
because how they dare you?
A key away. That's right.
So that's a real bullshit thing. However, so that means Heinrich could not be arrested and charged with that crime, even though his DNA matched and they know he did it. However, what they did instead was they got a search warrant issued for his home and they found child pornography in his house. Okay. So they arrested him on child pornography charges in October of 2015, because at this point they're just trying to like get him on something. And you'll remember they could match his DNA with Cheryl's case. Jacob's body had never been found. So there was like no they had his DNA, yes, but they couldn't connect it to Jacob because Jacob was never found.
Right. Okay.
Up to that point, even though they suspected him. So Heinrich, the guilty party, actually decided to cooperate with authorities after his arrest for child pornography. And as part of a plea bargain, he confessed to kidnapping and murdering Jacob Wetterling, as well as abducting and sexually assaulting Cheryl. So he did confess. And in September of 2016, he led investigators to a burial site where Jacob's clothing and remains were found. So they did finally find Jacob in 2016. In the plea agreement, Heinrich agreed to plead guilty to one count of the 25 federal child pornography charges brought against him. So his plea was to plead guilty to one count of child pornography charges. In exchange, he would confess, and the prosecutors agreed not to charge him with Jacob's murder.
Okay.
Which is crazy, but it ends up like,
okay. Yeah, because I was like, wait, what?
I know they have to do twisted things to get somebody, like, especially if they can't, if they don't think they can prove it.
Yeah, exactly.
They're going to get
what they want to find Jacob's body at this point. They want closure to that case. So essentially, it's like, however we can get that, we're going to try and get it. But I certainly was startled when I first read that. Like, what? You're not charging him with the murder? Okay. But Heinrich was sentenced to the maximum prison term of 20 years for the child pornography charge. So that does have very steep consequences, even just one charge, which is good. In addition, the plea deal allows for state authorities to seek his civil commitment as a sexual predator at the end of his federal prison term, which would prevent him from ever going free. Okay. So they kind of like built in some things to the plea deal to make sure he could really never get out of prison, which is good.
Good. Yeah.
It took 27 years, but Jacob's murderer had finally been caught. And again, I think it's really interesting that, you know, DNA had a component of this, as well as citizen sleuthing. And of course, the work of Jared Sherrill, who never gave up on finding his own attacker. But in the aftermath, there was a lot of criticism of law enforcement for how they handled this case. A number of their critical mistakes were reported in a podcast called In the Dark, season one of In the Dark podcast, that was released just after Heinrich's confession. And the podcast talks about how investigators failed to thoroughly canvass Jacob Wetterling's neighborhood in the days after his disappearance. And they didn't connect the Wetterling case to other similar crimes in the area, even though Heinrich was already a suspect. So you had these other kids who had not disappeared. They had not been kidnapped, but they had been either threatened or assaulted. And Heinrich was a suspect in those. So the police didn't make the connection between Jacob and those, essentially, which is a huge mistake.
It is. And I always think about, like, if you're the parent hearing that your kid died because...
Yes.
Those connections weren't made before.
Yep.
That's hard to hear.
Especially when it seems like in this case, sometimes I get it, but this one seems so obvious.
Right. I don't know quite when it was. Was it the 70s or the 80s when they really, I know there wasn't a much of an understanding of like these sexual attackers and stuff at a certain point too. And so it's just that we know so much now and looking back, we can't understand what was known about the psychology here, and it's obvious it might have been in reality, but this one does seem like
you're right. Maybe they were like, oh, but no, this boy was kidnapped. That's right. Totally different, even though it's happening in a similar area of Minnesota. It's the same age kids, you know,
same methodology.
And we all know that they escalate now, right? Like, we all know that there's an escalation that occurs. And so just because it's not the same crime, it's still a related crime. So,
but they literally like never put that together. Now, they did name Heinrich as a person of interest at some point, because I think they were kind of looking at sexual predators. So it's almost like talking out of both sides of their mouths there, that they like weren't related, but it did cross their minds. And they actually did find matching shoe prints and tire prints from the scene at that time from Heinrich. And they also found questionable photos of children in his home.
Oh.
Not photos that could be classified quite as child pornography.
But like if somebody were taking pictures at a playground of fully clothed kids, perhaps, that were there. Okay.
But they were like, they were described as questionable. And so even though, so they did question him and they did take his DNA and they did say, oh, the shoe prints and the tire prints matched, but they never made him a primary suspect. Even after all of that, they had named him as a person of interest, but never as a primary suspect. And then it never went anywhere.
That's bizarre.
Yeah. Like what?
So we're clearly there, sir, but we're not sure it's you, though. We don't. We're just going to forget it.
And then also, I think it was like 6 months prior to Jacob Wetterling's kidnapping, I mentioned Heinrich had been a suspect in some other attacks or kids being threatened. And the FBI actually decided to question him on those, but they took him in while he was drunk. They arrested him from a bar and took him in and questioned him about these attacks. And he claimed he was being framed. He was being set up. And you should never, I mean, it was like new agents questioning him. They were questioning him while he was drunk. It was definitely not how you would do an interrogation. And they ultimately released him. And that happened 6 months prior to Jacob Wetterling being kidnapped. So yeah. So you can imagine how people were a little disturbed to find out some of these things about law enforcement. And in 2018, a Stearns County sheriff, his name was Gudmundsen, actually released the state's investigative file. Cause obviously there were multiple law enforcements that were working on this, the FBI, the state, and it gave a detailed accounting of He gave a detailed accounting of how and why law enforcement botched the investigation. So this is very unusual for this sheriff to come out and say, yes, this investigation was botched. And he said, all of us failed, basically speaking on behalf of law enforcement, even though he was not the sheriff at the time. He is now the new sheriff who's looking back and saying, this, guys, this is not good. And I'm publicly going to admit it. The FBI disputes his claims of a botched investigation, of course, but has never released their files, even though he has called for them to do so. They never have. Uh-huh. So why is that?
Oh, I wonder.
I mean, yeah, the FBI probably has a lot of classified files they never want anyone to see.
You bet.
For various reasons. So yeah, it's a really like one of those cases where you have satisfaction because they did finally catch the guilty party, which is great, but it's so upsetting to look back and see how things could have been so differently, handled so differently, to prevent it ever from happening, to have caught him much sooner, and who knows what happened afterward. We don't know. You know, he moved around, Heinrich moved around afterward. We don't know what else he did.
Right, because they don't stop usually. So
right,
there's that's always such a big question when they catch somebody who did all these things and then like, oh, there's a bubble here where nothing happened. I doubt that.
No.
And there, I couldn't find anything about his life after, just very minimal things about where he lived and what kind of jobs he worked. But there is no information on it whether he continued to commit crimes. But like you said, I can't imagine he didn't, right? If this was his pattern, they usually don't stop. So anyway, I'll end with a quote from Judge Thunheim, who was the judge over Heinrich's sentencing hearing. He said, quote, "We won't pretend that this crime and sentence is about child pornography. It is also about changing the lives of so many children and parents who prayed for Jacob's return and also feared you coming out of the dark. Every child knows the story of Jacob Wetterling. You stole the innocence of children in small towns, in cities of Minnesota and beyond," end quote. And I think this is true. You know, as I said, I watched it happen. We all watched it happen and we were changed for it. Right. So yeah, that's the story of the kidnapping and murder of Jacob Wetterling. And my sources were People Magazine, ATI, ABC News, The End of the Dark podcast, and Wikipedia.
Nice. Wow.
Yeah. It's a doozy.
It's funny that what you were saying about citizen sleuthing and about the podcasting,
because I just read a new novel. I think the title was Almost Certainly Dead.
Yeah.
And
Patrick mentioned it. Did he? I'm a guest on the Functional Nerds, and I recorded that yesterday. So
I just read this, and there is some of the chapters are current time, some are the main character's childhood, and some are a podcast that these two true crime podcasters are doing about this woman's disappearance. They are the shittiest human beings. I was so deeply offended by how they portrayed podcasters because it was just, they were terrible. They had this guy on their podcast who was the ex fiance of a victim. And they were just like, oh, he was so cute. I can't believe he would do anything wrong. Oh, it was just awful.
Oh no. You're like, this is not how podcasters are.
That's what I thought the whole time watching that Kaylee Cuoco one. That was, it was a cute show, but I was like, inaccurate. But yes. Mine wasn't even about the podcasting on that though. I was like, that is not what true crime fans are like.
Yeah.
No.
Now, I will say these were it appeared to be two young women who already had sponsors.
So, oh, yeah. They're so
rarefied air there.
On okay. Citizen Sleuth, though, because, yeah, I also, Michelle McNamara, I think that's her name. Exactly. Mm-hmm. One of the most famous Citizen Sleuths, and somebody who shows you certainly what can be done by somebody who's outside the police department.
Mm-hmm.
And to her credit, she pushed until the police listened. To their credit, they did eventually listen. But I mean, she is even the one that coined the term Golden State Killer, right? Yeah,
that's right. To get more attention, to like give it a flashy name so people would pay attention. Yep.
Yeah. And I mean, although she in her case seems like kind of drove herself to an early that because she lived and breathed it. Her husband was Patton Oswalt, but
she became obsessed really in an unhealthy way, I think.
Oh, she did. Yeah. Cause he was like, she wouldn't eat and she wouldn't sleep. She'd sit up all night doing this stuff. Cause she'd catch something. Right. And then she'd have to follow that mm-hmm. until she found it. But amazing things can be done. And it's not even a commentary on the police because mm-hmm. they have all these cases at once. Right. And they have all the bureaucratic bullshit that they have to do. And they can only do so much about these things. And a lot of people will talk to a person that won't talk to a cop. We'll talk to a citizen mm-hmm. that won't talk to a cop too.
Yeah, that's right.
So there's a lot of that element. And so they can work hand in hand.
Well, like you were talking about with Gypsy Rose, when they thought there was something wrong in the house, there was nothing obvious mm-hmm. that would allow the police to enter the premises. But
what,
like,
if somebody in the neighborhood had been a sleuth? Yeah.
But they said to the guy, well, if you went in through that open window right. and told us what you found, that would be
acceptable.
That would be fine. We can't go in, but
we're not going to stop you because you're friends. So it's not trespass, right?
Like, and you see that sometimes. It's a trope almost in movies where somebody will go, they'll be like, well, no, that would be illegal. Well, I'm not a cop. I can do it.
I mean, like, for sleuthing books in general, right? Yes. Like, they have to be able to find a way to do the thing. And yep. So,
yeah. They don't care about the legality.
I think that there have been crimes that I can't cite anything other than really Golden State Killer thing helped them get there, but then it was other people, Paul Holes and whatnot.
Yep.
Now a Colorado Springs local.
I remember that now. Yes, he did.
Yes, he was here now.
So I'm going to round it up with some. I'm going to round it up with some murder.
Great. Bring us home.
That's right.
Bring it home with some moita. All right. So Bethany Liedline, and I'm just guessing because I'm not sure if that's how it's pronounced. But when she gets married, she has a different last name that I do know how to pronounce. She grew up in suburban Dallas with four siblings. They were a close-knit Christian family. All the kids were homeschooled up to a certain point. And I know she at least went on to I don't know if it was a public high school, but she went on to organized education after being homeschooled. And she won a scholarship to Southwestern University near Austin. And she was apparently very, very gifted with her writing, with her ability to put words together and paint images and be persuasive. And so had beautiful blue eyes. Everybody just loved everything about her. Yes, here I am. Look at me not giving any historical setting.
Why not?
I don't know. I just wanted to jump right into this one. So while she was in college, Bethany met Tyler Deaton, and they soon had a friend group of like-minded Christian young adults. So Bethany and Tyler started out praying together with friends once a week, and it grew and grew from there. Tyler led the prayer sessions that rapidly grew intense as they tried to heal the sick and ward off evil spirits. I don't know. That was the point where I said, do evil spirits have nothing better to do than hang out in a college dorm room?
Correct. Like, of all the places you can hang out as an evil spirit, perhaps that would be an interesting place some of the time.
Maybe.
I feel like it's really actually be quite boring a lot of the time.
I think it would be a really low bar to find people.
Like, look, they sleep, eat, and study.
And occasionally
party and have some sex.
Oh, I was going to say fornicate. But, I was also wondering what sick people they were trying to heal. That I always want to know. I'm like, who, if you fell ill, are you thinking, I need to swing by the local college campus and see if there's anyone available to pray over me? Or do you just pray away my liver failure? Or do you go to the doctor? I wanted much more detail on that. So at any rate, Bethany's parents at this point were very happy that she'd found friends she could share her faith with, because she'd have a very religious upbringing, and that she was still practicing her faith. Because that happens a lot. Kids go to college and it's the whatever they were raised with falls by the wayside. Some actively reject it. Some just let it go. I had a friend in college who gave up Catholicism for Lent one year and never went back. So Tyler became the leader of this little group. He called himself an apostle and explained it in a way that made sense to his friends, especially Bethany. She felt she'd met an amazing, brilliant man who loved God and wanted to be involved in missions and prayers. And that was a quote from Taryn O'Brien, who was a friend of Bethany's since like fourth grade. So
I knew a Taryn, but I've never heard her name from anybody else ever.
Is it T-E-R-Y-N?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I didn't like her, but I knew her.
I knew one other Taryn. It was spelled different.
In elementary school in Maryland, I knew a Taryn.
I knew a Taryn that I did not like.
Maybe that's why not many people are named Taryn.
Maybe it's the same Taryn. Are you sure it's not the same Taryn you both didn't like?
Does she appear in the spring?
No.
Okay.
That was in Maryland when I was in elementary school.
I was going to say, I think this one is too old to have been someone you went to school with. So anyway, unbeknownst to his friends, Tyler was grappling with a very special set of his own personal demons. He thought he was gay, and he spent a lot of time and a lot of energy trying to repress or change his sexuality. He believed that being a homosexual meant that he couldn't love God, which I'm like, or perhaps that God couldn't love him. So he refused to identify as gay. So Bethany was with him this whole time, helping him to try to not be gay. Yeah.
They were praying the gay away.
They were trying. Yeah. So in 2007, Tyler decided to focus on mission work. And so he went to Kansas City to attend a national convention hosted by IHOP, which is the International House of Prayer.
With pancakes.
We discussed this. Yes, we did before we started. But I'm going to refer to them as IHOP. So just remember, it's prayer, not pancakes.
So we're all going to leave here craving pancakes.
I already want pancakes.
I know. I'm making chicken for dinner. There's no pancake.
There's chicken and waffles. Why can't there be chicken and pancakes?
I'm sure there can.
That's a very good point.
I personally think pancakes go with everything.
You know, here, fun fact. I don't actually even like pancakes. I find them dry like biscuits most of the time. But Black Bear Diner has magical pancakes. And they're not dry. And I swear they put sugar in them. I don't know. They're magical. It's like vanilla and sugar in those puppies.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those are the only ones I can eat.
Alrighty then.
I know.
So Tyler, as I mentioned, was very charismatic. There's nobody ever. That's what all of his friends say. After graduating from college, Tyler, Bethany, and 20 members of their friend group packed up and moved to Kansas City to study and pray at IHOP. They settled into two houses. I know. I'm just going to laugh.
I still keep picturing it as a pancake house. I'm just picturing a bunch of people. I'm
picturing them in IHOP doing there.
But they settled in two houses. There was one for men and one for women, and they called themselves the community. So capital T, capital Z, the community. They worked together, they ate together, and they pooled their resources. So originally they were pooling their resources to get by. You know, you're just out of college, you're starting out, you don't have any money. And as Tyler got more involved in his, on his little crusade, he wanted to preach. He wanted to do this full time. So he needed them to support him. So some of them gave up, some of the people in this group gave up their career paths to just take jobs that would pay them so they could continue to support him. Bethany went back to school and became a nurse. Tyler assumed more and more control over the group. He dictated what people could wear, when to eat, and he supervised their romantic relationships. And anyone who didn't follow the rules was punished. For example, a girl who was deemed antisocial had her bedroom door taken away. Ugh, that would have pushed me right over the edge. So in November of 2008, group member Micah Moore claimed to have had a vision which predicted a tragedy at their university. In early December of that year, a philosophy major named Rob Atkinson was hit by a car and killed. Atkinson was someone who frequently butted heads with Tyler. Tyler referred to Atkinson as a harbinger of the Antichrist.
Whoa.
Yeah. So members of Tyler's little, I'm going to say this in quotes, Christian group took Atkinson's death as a good sign that their group was righteous and protected, and it helped really cement their convictions.
Gee.
Yeah. So remember Micah Moore. We're going to hear more from him later on. He was a young man with a lot of mental health issues, and his parents were constantly worried about him. They worried about psychotic breaks and his mental health in general. He was very easily influenced, especially by Tyler. Everybody who met him thought he was just this sweet kind of puppy dog. You know, he always had his guitar with him, and he was always finding people to jam with, and he just was a guy who wanted to belong. So in 2010, which was 2 years after founding the community, Tyler decided he had feelings for Bethany. He acknowledged her deep and abiding love for him and declared himself a changed man. Bethany was thrilled with this news, and they married in August of 2012, which actually she had completed nursing school earlier that same month. So they flew to Costa Rica for their honeymoon, but their union was never consummated. The spirit was willing, but the flesh was weak. Was all. but yeah, and Tyler readily admitted this, that no, they never consummated their marriage. One member of the group later said that Tyler told him he'd been practicing for his honeymoon with another man, not in a sexual way, but in a physical way.
Denial is such a strong drug.
Naked wrestling or push-ups. I'm like,
yeah, I both want to know what the difference is and don't want to know.
Yeah. Well, we're going to get kind of, anyway, at any rate, Tyler continued his sexual relationships with male members of the group after his wedding and honeymoon. What happened to Bethany while all this fornicating was going on? Tyler claimed Bethany was unaware of his infidelities, but also asserted that she blamed herself for their lack of intimacy. She started speaking with her family and friends less and less, which was common. Tyler was cutting everybody off from outside support that they could have gotten. When she tried to raise any issues with him, he had her shunned by the community for daring to speak out. There was another man who was shunned by the community. They communicated with him like once or twice a month by slipping a note under his door.
Oh.
Yeah, because we're 12 now. While Tyler claims that Bethany was depressed and appeared suicidal, none of the rest of their friend group seemed to notice. They didn't notice the depression. They didn't know she'd been admitted to a psych ward after she threatened suicide. And Tyler made sure that her parents didn't know. He later claimed that was her decision, that she was so ashamed and so embarrassed, she didn't want anyone to know about it. He also asserted, and he was such a colossal dickhead, he also asserted that he thought the whole thing was an act to get attention. And I'm like, that's talking out of both sides of your mouth.
Right.
Yeah.
She was ill and then claimed she was just doing it for attention. Which was it? Not that I think he was the arbiter of what she was, but it's like, which are you going to claim it was? On October 29th, 2012, Tyler gave an intense sermon exhorting his followers, because by this time, that's what they were, to make a choice between the community and their own personal selfishness. People who were there later said they believed he was targeting Bethany in particular because she was sitting in the room during the sermon, sitting on the floor with her back to the wall, her knees pulled up to her chest with her arms around her knees, and just a mortified look on her face. I'm like, why did no one try to help this woman at that point? Mm-hmm. So the next morning, Bethany got up and went to her nursing job. But 12 hours later, the Jackson County Sheriff's Office got a call about a female body in a van. Police discovered Bethany's body in the back of the van. A plastic bag loosely covered her head, and there was an empty bottle. Okay, when I first read this, this empty bottle of sleeping pills. It was not. It was an empty bottle of Tylenol PM.
Yeah, those are very different.
I'm like, okay, so there was an empty bottle.
It's an empty bottle of melatonin. Yeah. It's fine.
So there's an empty bottle of Tylenol PM next to her, as well as a full unopened bottle. There was also a goodbye note, but police investigating the scene felt that something was off. The detective who informed Tyler of his wife's passing said his reaction was not what he expected. Tyler said he was in shock and just trying to keep it together. So I'm going to veer quickly into a side note, because we've talked about this almost every time the police said, well, their reaction was not what we expected. Grief is so individualized, I don't think you can use that as a basis for suspecting anyone of anything. It's as individual as your fingerprints. He wasn't skipping around singing and humming, "Ding dong, the witch is dead." So just because.
Hell, even then doesn't mean you did it.
Like, that is true. That is true. But just because he didn't live up to the police's arbitrary expectation doesn't mean he didn't feel anything. Although in retrospect, at any rate, the medical examiner ruled Bethany's cause of death as suicide. Her mother begged the police to investigate further, as I think many mothers would. Her body was returned to Dallas for her funeral, which was attended by hundreds of people. It overflowed the funeral home, the church. But the family got a phone call that day from the police, and they asked that Bethany's body not be buried, and they would like to have it returned for further investigation.
Can we have that body back?
That would just, yeah. Bethany's close friend and Tyler's lover, Micah Moore, had walked into a police station and confessed.
I'm sorry, you mean his wrestler buddy?
Well, yeah, his good friend. Wrestling partner and good friend, had confessed to Bethany's murder. When officials questioned Moore, he seemed reluctant to talk, especially for someone who had voluntarily confessed when he wasn't even under suspicion. He said he'd put the bag over Bethany's head and held it closed until, quote, her body shook. That did match the evidence because, here's a gross little detail for you, her body was found with her eyes open, which is highly unusual if someone had overdosed on anything with a sedative effect, because generally, as your body is kind of slowing down, and you close your eyes and you go to sleep or you lose consciousness. And so the that was one detail that stuck out, that if she had killed herself, her eyes should be closed, not open. Bethany's mother called bullshit on the whole thing. She questioned why a nurse would choose to, who had worked earlier that day on an oncology unit, I think she worked with cancer patients, why she would choose to OD on Tylenol PM when she had access to better, stronger drugs at her work. Also, she was found with, like in her bag, were thank you notes from her wedding. Not completed ones, but like she was sitting in the back of the van writing these notes when she died. They were like some were finished and hadn't been put in the envelope, or they were in the envelope and they hadn't been addressed. So it was like an interrupted task. Her goodbye note said, "My name is Bethany Deaton. I chose this evil thing. I did it because I wouldn't be a real person, and what is the point of living if it is too late for that? I wish I had chosen differently a long time ago. I knew it all and refused to listen. Maybe Jesus will still save me." So everyone who knew her said that didn't sound like her. Although I will say, if someone is suicidal, would they sound like they did every other day of their life? So I'm not sure if that was, but however.
Yes, sometimes.
I don't know. I don't have the answer to that. But the wording of that note surprises me because of the issue that Tyler was dealing with. I wish I wouldn't be a real person. I wish I'd chosen differently. Maybe Jesus will say, that all sounds to me like him speaking, yeah. Not her. Why did Micah Moore suddenly confess when he did? IHOP held a meeting immediately after Bethany's death and said, basically, you can follow Tyler Deaton or you can be part of IHOP. He is not part of us. We have nothing to do with him. He is cut off, expunged, excommunicated. You can choose now. So following the meeting, Moore asked the IHOP leaders to take him to the police station where he confessed. Now, police say he had details that made sense, details that only someone who had been present at the time of death would know. But then Moore told them that his motive for killing Bethany, he said that Tyler asked him to do it. Tyler, who at this point doesn't know Moore has confessed, denies everything. Mm-hmm. The story takes another fucked up turn. Moore told the police that he and several other roommates had been secretly dosing Bethany with Seroquel, which is an antipsychotic, and sexually assaulting her for months. Quick reminder that these people were supposed to be members of a Christian fellowship. That was the whole reason they were living together in the first place. Also, I'm going to jump ahead a little bit here. When they did the tox screen later, there was no trace of the drug in Bethany's system, and there was no physical evidence to support sexual assault. That's not to say it couldn't have happened further back in the past, but the police looked for that specifically. Moore said that Tyler Deaton feared Bethany was going to talk to a therapist about everything, and he wanted her silenced. Tyler denied it. He denied being anything like a cult leader. He blamed Moore's confession on the controlling leadership of IHOP. He said, basically, he said, I lost my wife, I lost all my friends, and I lost my church in the span of 10 days. Then he said, if I'm a cult leader, I must be a very bad one.
I mean, you were, but you made that cult too good. And yeah. It controlled you, I guess.
He was just... Some of the questions and answers, because there's a 48 hours interview, you can tell how he's staging his answers. When he's asked a question, he's being really, really very clever. And he's thinking three steps ahead about how things he say will be perceived and how they're going to play out in the media and how not to implicate himself. He engages in a lot of clever and evasive wordplay. After Moore's confession, at least four men from Tyler's group came to the police and said they had been manipulated into having secret affairs with Tyler that he referred to as religious experiences.
Kind of cocky, you know?
They all think that, don't they? I mean, the ego. So they're asking Tyler about this. He claims he never had intercourse with any of these men, although he did admit that there were hands put in places. He admitted to lying in bed together, and he admitted to oral sex. So I guess he just meant no butt stuff. And I guarantee that listener, our supporter and listener, Amy, just spit her tea all over her computer screen. So then Moore recanted his entire confession. His attorney claimed that IHOP had performed an exorcism on him, complete with very intense yelling, scream praying, talking in tongues, telling these kids that they were to blame for Bethany's death. The International House of Prayer, of course, denied anything of the sort. They had been pulling back from Tyler's community for some time, but after Bethany's death, they severed ties completely. So police admit the evidence could go either way, supporting either the suicide theory or the murder theory. Eventually, charges against Moore were dropped because there was not enough evidence to convict him. Police still consider this an open case, and they are not convinced at all that Bethany committed suicide. So as a follow-up to the 48 hours episode on this topic, Bethany's parents are suing the district attorney for access to the evidence in her case, and it was not able to find out if they'd gotten it or not. And Tyler has said he planned to pay back her parents for the wedding, but has not done so. So that just, it was just so creepy and so sad. And so my sources for this were CBS News, the New York Times, and Unresolved.
See, we can laugh about it, but the fact that the extremist religious bigots make it so hard for somebody to just be open about who they are is sad and is a problem and is a cause of suicide. And so, you know, in that way, not at all funny. Denial, though, often is funny in how somebody will twist things in their mind so much just to be able to rationalize it and justify it and all of that. But yeah, I mean, it's sad he was in that position because clearly he was gay.
Yes.
And that's not a thing you can change, just in case. I don't think anybody would still be listening to this podcast if they believed it wasn't true, because I'm sure we've drummed them out at this point.
Yes. But,
you know, just for the record.
Well, and I thought it was very interesting that it's in one of the quotes was that he felt that as a gay man, he couldn't love God.
Right.
Not that he felt God that was couldn't striking. Love him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it probably meant a lot of the same to him. Like, probably. It was probably to him a given that God wouldn't love him for it. And he could not in turn.
Just think of all the positive, all that being charismatic, being a good speaker,
being organized so that you could put something like this together.
Think of how much good he could have done if he could have accepted about himself. Mm-hmm. He was gay. He could have done a lot of great work in the Christian community as a gay leader.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Would the entire Christian community have accepted him? Probably not.
Nope, because some of them are bigots.
Yeah. But some of it.
I just want to be really clear.
Turns out.
I hide my feelings really well. And
When is it you do that? Wait, I haven't said fuck the patriarchy yet. Shh,
don't speak. Like, yes, we just did. There, you got that in there.
I got to slip that in every episode. But I mean, yeah, there was a lot that it's a very, very sad story. There were a lot of details that, of course, I rely on humor to cope with fucking everything. So the fact that it was called IHOP just really, because the Pancake House has been around for a long time. I
made an odd choice, but gotta laugh when you have the opportunity. You know, you can't just constantly cry at the state of the world. So
no, I've tried that. That doesn't work either. No,
it made me think every time I was like Tyler in a cult, it made me think of Tyler Durden in Fight Club. Very different Tyler here, I suppose. All right. So it is time to wrap it up. But Angela, where can people find you? Give out that information and throw out your books one more time.
Sure. So you can find me at angelasylvain.com. And my most recent novel is Frostbite. And I also have a collection coming out in May of 2024 that's called The Dead Spot, Stories of Lost Girls. So you can check that out too.
Yay. And Sylvain is Sylvaine for folks. And thanks for listening, tuning in.
Yes.
And we'll talk at you in a month on the 15th of each month.
We will talk to you in February.
Thank you, Angela, for coming on and chatting with us and talking about a crime that I think a lot of us of our age, at least, are very aware of, but didn't know all the details on.
Thank you.
I'm not even sure I knew they'd remembered, I guess. I probably did hear it at some point that they had found the body, you know? So like that was at least new at this time to me. I don't know what I've forgotten anymore at this point. but thanks guys for tuning in, and we'll talk to you later.
Bye. Thank you for listening to Mysteries, Monsters, and Mayhem.
Find us on Facebook and Instagram or at our website, mysteriesmonstersmayhem.com.
Please like, rate, and review, follow, and share wherever your favorite podcasts are downloaded.
Thank you for listening and supporting our podcast. We'll be back next week with more shenanigans.